You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, September 10th, 2014, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
I haven't seen you guys since Dragon Con.
How is
that
right?
True.
I know. Yeah.
We had a week off.
Missed you guys.
A lot has happened.
I have a
very
quick,
good time.
Quick list of memories. Ready? One, wow, it was hot. Two,
hot.
Rebecca had an amazing costume.
Thank
awesome.
You.
Glowing
Three,
guys.
Bob and Rebecca were sitting next to each other with wigs on in a bar and didn't recognize each other. I'll never forget that.
Oh, I yep. forgot about that. I loved it.
Four, Evan looks completely badass in a beard. And Evan, do you still have the beard?
Let's see. Now, because you said I look totally badass, I'll have to say, yes, I still have the beard.
Good for you. Good for
and
you.
Thank goodness this is an audio-only podcast.
Oh, Evan, you have to keep the beard.
You know, I do have a day job and all that, but at least I know I can grow it. It takes a couple weeks, and I think we will see it again someday.
Good.
And it was also awesome. We got to hang out with a bunch of our SGU friends and family, like people that help us with our stuff that we've gotten close to. So it's always awesome to go to Dragon Con.
Hey, happy crowbar through the head day, everybody.
Nice. Yeah. I hate when that happens.
Is that an expression like good luck? You know, when they say break your neck or break your leg or something?
Yeah. Crowbar through your head.
Right back at you.
On September 13th, 1848, Phineas Gage was working on the railroad in Vermont.
All the live long day.
Mm-hmm. When there was a planned explosion that went slightly awry when a tamping iron flew out and pierced Gage through the head, basically through his left eye, straight through his brain and out the back of his skull. Amazingly, he was like, I'm fine. And then he got up and walked to a little coach and sat down and was perfectly fine for the ride into town. It was like a mile or two. And then sat and waited for the doctor, who came up, and Gage was like gushing blood everywhere, but it was otherwise perfectly fine, and like explained everything that happened to the doctor. And my favorite detail was that the doctor was skeptical of Gage's claim until Gage started puking, and the force of his puke caused a bit more of his brain to pop out of his skull.
Oh, what?
And onto the floor.
That gave Bob an idea for his next Halloween costume.
Yeah.
Oh, that would be an amazing costume.
Oh, yeah.
Actually.
Phineas Gage. That would be cool.
Yeah. That would be really awesome.
So I'm a bit of a fan of this whole Phineas Gage story. So I have to tweak a couple of details that you said there, Rebecca. So he was actually using the tamping rod, and which, you know, essentially he was like using it to pack down explosives.
Oh, he was tamping.
He was tamping down the explosive with this 43-inch long rod. And
43?
He hit the side of the hole, which set the spark, which ignited the explosives that he was tamping down, which shot the rod right up. You know, he was holding it at the time, shot it right up through his head. And it exited the top of his skull, not the back of his skull. Mm-hmm. So essentially, it took out his left frontal lobe and his left eye. His left eye was gone. Left frontal lobe basically destroyed.
So like there's like a nanosecond lobotomy is what it was.
Yeah, although it's not really a lobotomy, because lobotomies are, you know, as a surgical procedure, is much more precise and would have
a different effect. Shit, Steve.
Yeah, but it would actually have a completely different effect.
No, you see, Bob, a lobotomy is often performed in a surgical environment by a doctor. This was a tamping rod driving the skull.
Like saying Kennedy had a lobotomy.
So he wasn't fine, though, either, right? I mean, in my reading, he had some significant emotional and psychological effects from the injury.
Well, that's what
But he was fine in that he was alive. So, Steve, please, let's address that first. How could you survive such a heinous injury as that?
It's actually not that uncommon. It happens every now and then.
Oh my God.
In fact, there was a case that happened in 2012 in Brazil, Eduardo Leite, L-E-I-T-E, construction worker, almost exactly the same kind of injury. A rod fell off of a building he was working on, went through the top of the right top of his skull and out between his eyes, taking out his right frontal lobe. So very similar kind of case, but we actually have modern medical imaging because the case happened in 2012. There's actually a study in 2012 also where researchers tried to reconstruct the damage that was done to Gage's brain based upon what data that we have. And they concluded that he had extensive, as you might imagine, extensive damage to the white matter connections throughout his brain. It's actually a little controversial what the net neurological effect was on Gage. One description that we have from his physician, though this comes from him remembering years later, was that Gage went from being sort of a calm, wise person, although not educated, but, you know, a very together kind of calm person, to being
irascible.
Yeah, rude, vulgar, you know, uncontrollable, which is one of the frontal lobe syndromes. You know,
I'd be pissed too if I lost part of my brain.
Yeah, but it also happens if you damage your frontal lobes enough. Yeah. You basically can't inhibit your behavior.
Yeah, he just became like pure id.
Yeah.
What I found interesting was that apparently the doctor didn't publicize that personality change immediately because Gage was still alive, which I found really kind of nice, but also not that great for science. That he didn't publish all of this until after Gage's death. But then also there are reports of him, Gage, in his later life, getting better, and, you know, people saying like, no, he's not that bad.
Yeah.
And it's hard to say because it's not like he had one therapist that he was seeing throughout his life. It was just, you know, new friends because he pretty much left his old life. Nobody could stand him anymore. He went to Chile, to become a coach driver, basically. And, there people reported that he, you know, didn't seem to have those same sort of personality traits that people said he had immediately after the accident. So maybe he got better, or maybe people just had a different perspective on him. Who knows?
Yeah. The other thing is, so he was 25 when this happened. He actually died only 12 years later. He didn't survive long. And he had horrible seizures from the trauma to his brain.
Ooh. Yikes.
Yeah.
Probably also had a brain infection. And again, he probably eventually died from those complications of his injury. So he wasn't quote unquote fine. You know, yeah, he did survive for 12 years, but it took its toll. Did you guys know that a couple years ago, this organization was taking these old daguerreotypes and were, I think, scanning them and uploading them online? Daguerreotype is
like a movie.
It's an old type. No, it's a picture, a portrait. Right? It's a portrait. Oh.
The first pictures, they were created on like a hard metal plate, weren't they?
Yeah. So in 2009, actually. So they were putting all these vintage photos up on this site, a social sharing website, and somebody scrolling through them said, "Holy shit, that's a picture of Phineas Gage."
Oh,
and
wow.
It's a picture of Phineas Gage. He's holding the tamping rod that went through his skull.
Yep.
And his left eye is gone. I mean, you can see that his left lid is closed. You know, there's no eye there. And, you know, he's a young, handsome guy otherwise. Very interesting. And then since then, his family showed another picture of him. So now there's two known public pictures of Phineas Gage. But in 2009, that was the first known yeah. picture of Phineas Gage. Incredible.
Oh, wow. Well, there's just quite a few pictures of him. And, the tamping iron is in a museum.
Yeah,
along with his skull. It's at the Warren Museum at Harvard.
So, Steve, does this in fact prove the idea that we only use 10% of our brain?
No, in fact, it shows the opposite. It's also a good case. You know, when people like dualists say that, you know, somehow our personality is something other than the meat inside of our head. It's like, yeah, but I could, you know, if you damage your frontal lobe, you have a complete change in personality.
Yeah,
you know, you change that meat inside your head and you change profoundly, profoundly. Yeah. There's just a historical case that illustrates that. And speaking of
whoa,
it's like historical figures, you guys have all heard of Jack the Ripper.
Yes.
No.
Yes.
I know the Ripper, yeah.
The Ripper. Yes. Probably the most iconic serial killer in history.
Uh-huh.
And so iconic, in fact, that he made an appearance on Star Trek, the original series.
That's
so,
right.
Wow.
That's right. Very cool.
Red
Very
Jack.
Cool. You know.
Also the,
Red Jack, Red Jack.
The subject of a time traveling movie with H.G. Wells.
Yes. Great movie. Right. Time After Time.
Time After Time.
Oh, yeah. That's movie. Right. Malcolm McDowell.
Malcolm McDowell. Very good. So anyway, one of the enduring mysteries, and I think part of the mystique and, you know, the nature of the Jack the Ripper story is that nobody knows who he was. You know, an English gentleman murdering prostitutes in Whitechapel. And of course, the speculation about who it could have been is, you know, a favorite hobby. And of course, famous people always get attached, you know, to this sort of thing. Well, a couple of researchers claim that they have finally solved the mystery of who Jack the Ripper was.
Mm-hmm.
Was his name Jack?
So here's their story. So Russell Edwards came into the possession of a bloody shawl, which apparently was found with the last, you know, generally accepted victim of Jack the Ripper, Catherine Adowes. Apparently, the story goes that a police officer who was working the case at the time took the shawl home to his wife as a gift.
Oh, boy.
So romantic.
And
yeah.
I love you, honey. Here's a shawl
Here
from a nasty
honey.
Murder scene.
Yeah. And she apparently never cleaned it, but stashed it away in a trunk somewhere. And it got passed down through the family, you know, and 126 years later.
Ew.
Well, Edwards acquired it, I think, like 6 or 7 years ago. In 2007, and then he solicited the help of Dr. Jerry Luhalainen, a Finnish expert in historic DNA. And so Luhalainen extracted mitochondrial DNA from the shawl. But to back up a little bit, so there was obviously a lot of blood, and it's probably all Adowes, right, all the victims. But under black light, he found a semen stain on the shawl.
Oh.
Now, he said that. You okay there, Evan? That.
Yeah, sorry. I just thought of Perry. Sorry. Go ahead.
Genomic DNA, you know, the DNA that would be in the nucleus, that would not have survived intact enough over 126 years to do any kind of genomic DNA matching. But mitochondrial DNA is much hardier, and it's packed inside the mitochondria. If you could find a mitochondria, you could actually get some intact mitochondrial DNA. However, sperm have very few mitochondria. But he found an epithelial cell on the sperm stain, and probably from, you know, the urethra of whatever person deposited the semen on the shawl. And from that, he extracted mitochondrial DNA and was able to do, you know, polymerase chain reaction, expand it, type it. Mitochondrial DNA has certain finite haplotypes. This turned out to be T1A1, which is a Eurasian mitochondrial haplotype, although apparently less common in England and more common in Northern Europe. Now, Luhalainen had a suspect in mind. One of the people who's always been on the short list of suspects is Aaron Kosminski, who is a Pole, who's Polish. About 3 years after the last generally accepted murder of Jack the Ripper, he actually was put in an insane asylum, and he spent the rest of his life in asylums and died in an asylum in 53. He was 23 at the time of the murders in 1888, and he was living in Whitechapel, was known to frequent prostitutes, so he's got a lot of the profile. So what Luhalainen did is he actually tracked down a female lineage relative of Kosminski. The Kosminski's sister's,
wow,
whatever, granddaughter, great granddaughter through a maternal line, so that that person would share mitochondrial DNA with, yeah, Kosminski, and she has the same haplotype, T1A1. So Edwards and Luhalainen concluded from that this ties Kosminski to the murder, and therefore he's Jack the Ripper. What do you guys think about that?
Nope.
Well, I mean,
bloody shawl you're bringing home as a gift for your
wife.
What's with
that? A lot of ifs, you know, and a lot of, you know, you're tying a lot of conclusions to a lot of thin evidence.
Yeah, and I mean, there are myriad problems with it. I actually just got off of a conversation with our two forensic scientists on Skeptic.
What are they?
Oh,
know?
Yeah.
We were discussing this case, and they actually identified so many more problems than what even I had noticed. I mean, the first thing that's got to trip your skeptical alarms is that this is not being published for the first time in any kind of scientific journal.
Not peer-reviewed, correct.
No. There's a book coming out, and they gave the world exclusive to the Daily Mail.
Oh.
So that's number one, where you're like, okay, that's a bit of a, you know, a little alarm bell.
Hello, yeah.
Off.
Like, why out of all the opportunities that they should have had, is that where they're going?
Yeah.
We will kindly call that unorthodox. That's kind.
Then you've got, you know, a 126-year-old scarf. We have no, shawl. we don't have any real idea of its provenance.
Right.
Where'd it come from? Whose is it?
It's supposedly was removed by this police officer who claimed he was at the scene, but he is not listed as being at the scene according to any historical documents. And also the police reports at the time carefully detail everything that was at that crime scene, and there is no shawl on the list.
Cause he nicked it.
Well, yeah, that's the.
I'll bring his open to misses.
Let's say that happened. Yeah, like great present for the little lady. And then it's never washed or touched. Like it's handled with gloves and put in a plastic bag. No, like it's being thrown around, passed from person to person.
Yeah, but Rebecca, do you think somebody jizzed on it?
Well, seeing as it was supposedly found in the possession of a prostitute, I would say yes. Probably
okay, there you go.
Somebody jizzed on
it. That's a good answer.
So there's to add to that. So maybe it was in a trunk for 100 years, but there's clearly once it was taken out and put up for auction, many people were seen to be handling it, getting their mitts all over it, their spit all over it. So it probably is rife with contamination.
Yeah, and even then, I mean, it wasn't sitting in a trunk that whole time. You know, they say that it was, he like gave it to a museum or something and then they gave it back. Because there was just no, they couldn't verify where it came from. So it was just sitting in storage. So yeah, that's all very suspicious. There are a million more problems with the fact that this researcher claims in the Daily Mail article and like, who knows how much they get right and how much they get wrong. Again, that's why we publish in peer-reviewed journals and not the Daily Mail.
Right.
But they report him as saying that he developed his own revolutionary technique for extracting this DNA called DNA vacuuming. Well, Amanda Linebow, one of our forensic scientists, pointed out what he sort of describes is a technique that already exists and that he certainly did not come up with. But that said, if he did come up with some new method that did in fact lead to the outrageous claims he's making of having like absolute 100% certainty of his result, then there is no way that the scientist should be keeping this to himself and revealing it only in a Daily Mail article. Again, like, let's forget about their results with the Jack the Ripper case. Let's just talk about this one magnificent technique that would easily rocket into a journal with no trouble at all. Because, as both, Ray and Amanda pointed out to me, DNA is a hot field of study.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of money there and people are desperate to find any kind of new quick way to, you know, find people based on like very tiny amounts of evidence. Like that is something very much in demand. So it's very suspicious.
And when you have a book coming out as well, you know, it kind of helps to.
What with a book you know, coming out and all?
Exactly.
Another thing that, that I've read a couple of people point out was that he did not appear to do blinded sampling analysis and did not have any controls. How about testing against, you know, random controls or other suspects? And it is standard procedure in this, for this kind of test to be done blinded. And it wasn't. He knew what he was looking for. So it's at the very least, until we have an independent replication with blinded samples. You know, it's hard to even take it seriously.
This is in the Shroud of Turin territory.
Well, probably not that bad, but it's, yeah, I mean, it's just, it's way premature to say they nailed it. They got it. Mystery solved. I mean, we're way too preliminary for that. And then someone else pointed out, even if everything else is correct and, you know, they correctly identified Kosminski's mitochondrial DNA on the shawl.
That doesn't mean it was him.
Doesn't mean that he killed her because he frequented prostitutes in Whitechapel, where he lived. He probably jizzed off on every prostitute in Whitechapel. I mean, seriously, that's it still wouldn't prove that he's Jack the Ripper, that he killed her, even if everything else turns out to be verified. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And one other weird thing that the researcher said, is that he was able to determine from the mitochondrial DNA that the owner of the semen had dark hair.
Yeah, I was curious
what
about
was that
too.
About? Yeah,
which both Ray and Amanda were like, no, you can't. That's not what mitochondrial DNA
and that,
tells you.
That kind of scares me that he said that. Right, that's him tipping his hand.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly makes him very suspect. Like, you know, again, if this is published in the Daily Mail, so who knows what they might have gotten wrong? But it's in his own words. I can't imagine that they would screw things up that badly. So, yeah, I mean, he doesn't seem like he knows what he's talking about at all. So, yeah, it's highly suspect.
Other than that.
Highly suspect, yeah. Self-promotion in excess of science, sounds like. Okay, well, Evan, I understand there are some problems with Common Core, right? Like, as if this is news.
Right, that is for sure. So, but what it has to do with this time around, Steve, is that it's creationism, and creationism news is coming out of Ohio this past week. There's a bill in the state legislature calling for the repeal of Common Core. Now, Common Core is an education standards initiative, and currently 43 of the 50 states in the USA are participating in this initiative. Among the Common Core standards are standards for mathematics, English language subjects, American history, and science. Now, not all people are happy with these standards, as you alluded to, Steve. There are very vocal throngs of people objecting to Common Core standards for a whole host of reasons. You know, some don't like it academically, some don't like it politically, and some people think it's just too hard or confusing. You know, kids are bringing homework home that their parents can't even figure out what is going on. So it has its detractors, shall we say.
One thing I found interesting is that from the political right, it's being criticized as a government takeover of education.
Right, a federal
standard. Yeah, which it really isn't. It's actually not a federal standard. It's totally initiated by the states. But on the left, there's very sharp criticism saying that it's a corporate takeover of education, especially Diane Ravitch. She's an education historian.
Her.
Yeah. So she's very, very critical, saying that it emphasizes way too much standardized testing and restricts schools and teachers from, you know, teaching what they should be teaching to teaching to the test so that students perform on to game the system. It's interesting when a policy like this gets attacked so vociferously from both sides of the political spectrum.
That's right. So you can't line it up ideologically one way or the other. It's just, you know, again, hosts of reasons as to why people disagree with going this route. But regardless, it is happening. And naturally, politically speaking, there are movements underway in just about all of these 43 states to repeal the standards. In one way or the other, these groups want them repealed. But with Ohio, one of Ohio's repeal efforts might actually serve as a tunnel for creationism to be introduced into the curriculums all throughout Ohio. And it's a pending bill in the House, House Bill 597. And the language in it is actually quite vague, which is one of the main problems with it. But there are a few sentences about the science standards specifically, which has science educators and science advocates on alert. Here's how it reads. The standards in science shall be based in core existing disciplines of biology, chemistry, and physics, shall incorporate grade level mathematics and be referenced to the mathematics standards, shall focus on academic and scientific knowledge rather than scientific processes, and shall prohibit political or religious interpretation of scientific facts in favor of another.
Right.
So those last two sentences are quite troubling. I actually added in a couple shalls there just to kind of separate a little. It reads a little weird otherwise. So I wanted to point it out for emphasis.
So essentially, you can't say that evolution happened. I think that's where they're going with that. You know, again, the creationists are trying to get more and more subtle in their ways of inhibiting or undermining the teaching of evolution or allowing for creationist, you know, talking points into the classroom. So this is it. This is sounds like a new strategy, you know, where they're trying to get even more subtle, talking about you can't talk about scientific processes.
Right. And they're kind of piggybacking onto the opposition to Common Core effectively to kind of ride it through. It can't, obviously it can't go through on its own merits. So it has to sort of attach itself to another set of ideas or principles that people are arguing. And whether they know it or not, while it's piggybacking on its way, you've kind of created this little tunnel by which this window opens. And these sorts of things can be interpreted as being okay to teach in the school, such as creationism. Yeah. Now, the other thing about this is when it has to do with shall prohibit political or religious interpretation of scientific facts in favor of another. I think what they're alluding to there specifically is the teaching of global climate change.
Mm-hmm.
Right? They want to try, when they say prohibit political interpretation of scientific facts, that's code for,
I think you're right.
You're not going to teach about global warming.
Right.
In the class.
And then religious is, you know, the Big Bang and evolution.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So it's kind of a 1-2 punch, but it kind of shows you what the core weakness is, if I may use the term, of this entire bill is that it's so vague, way too loose, and you're basically going to open the door to these things and perhaps other non-scientific things coming into the classrooms. And, you know, all on the back of, the idea that there are problems with the Common Core, and you can have that debate. That's fine. You know, pro, con, and so forth. Let's have that. But let's not make it so that a trail is blazed by which all these other anti-science things can flow through.
Yeah, they're exploiting the controversy over Common Core to sneak in some creationist purposed, you know, language. It's deliberately vague so that after the fact they could use it to justify whatever the hell they want to do, basically.
Thank goodness for our friends over at the places like the National Center for Science Education, who are on top of these things happening at the state level. Very important to understand that these groups are working within our states, and we need to support them as much as possible because they're kind of the watchdogs for this kind of stuff. And thank goodness they're making us aware of it.
Yeah, I agree. We do have to turn to another problem with science, Jay. Canada's so-called war on science. Tell us what this is about.
Yeah, it's not just limited to Canada, but Canada seems to be at the forefront of this. Wow, is this weird and depressing. The French National Trade Union of Scientific Researchers, they surveyed higher education and research unions in 12 countries around the globe, and that includes France, Argentina, Canada, Denmark, Italy, Portugal, Russia, Senegal. Where is that, by the way?
It's in Africa, right?
Serbia, Spain, and the UK and the US, okay? The research union found international governments are aiming for policies, quote, geared towards innovation in order to spur consumption and competitiveness. Now, that might sound not terrible, but it is terrible, and I'll tell you why. So, in short, these governments are manipulating science, research, scientists, the whole process of science, and science communication, most of all, to boost their economies, their local economies. And this may be better described as politicians looking for short-term gains over long-term research that could have a much more profound impact on people, particularly the future. And if you think about what I just said, and think about the fact that politicians have terms, or most politicians have terms, and they want to show a dramatic benefit, you know, now as opposed to doing things or building programs for the future. That sucks, and it sucks for a lot of reasons.
Yeah.
Now, arguably, the worst case here is Canada. So Stephen Harper, the Prime Minister of Canada, since 2006, has been preventing scientists from doing a lot of things. And one of them, and I think the most obvious one, is the fact that scientists no longer can speak freely about their own research.
Yeah, we talked about this a few weeks ago, right?
Yeah, we touched on this.
Mm-hmm.
Federal scientists must get upper-level bureaucratic approval before they can speak with the media about their work. Just think about that. They have to get approval before they can communicate about their research to just the media, to people that are interested, or, you know, people that want to write articles about it, educate the public, do the types of things that, you know, we do here on the SGU. They need permission. An example of this is a scientist named Scott Dalimore, who had to get specific ministerial permission to talk to the media about a flood that occurred 13,000 years ago. I mean, this sounds like the evil ministry of magic run by the Death Eaters, you know, like,
mm-hmm.
like seriously, like
what, the, yeah, what, right? What did you just say? Was that,
that was a Harry Potter stroke? Reference. Harry Potter. Reference.
Oh. Harry Potter.
Harry Potter. The ministry of magic. Remember when the Death Eaters, Voldemort's followers, like start to infiltrate the ministry of magic. Read yes. the books. Okay, so Canada's so-called this war on science is doing a lot of things to limit scientific research. It's closing scientific centers, programs. Thousands of government scientist jobs have been just obliterated. They're gone. These people have lost their jobs. The jobs don't exist anymore. In 2008, Harper government eliminated the position of the National Science Advisor. Well, you know what? We don't need a National Science Advisor anymore. Meaning, we don't need anyone to talk to us about science because we're just not going to conduct it anymore. I think everybody that listens to the show should just take a moment to read about this on your own. There's a lot to read. There's a lot of details. A lot of things have happened since 2006. But, you know, in essence, what we're seeing here is the government coming down so hard on science that they are bringing it almost to a screeching halt.
Yeah, this is a problem in a couple of ways. And it goes beyond, obviously, as you said, Jay, Canada. And it also goes beyond just this current problem of inappropriately shifting resources to translational research, research that gets immediate results, and rather than basic science research. So the complaint is we're not funding basic science enough. At the same time, there are reports indicating that government funding of basic science goes through these boom and bust cycles, you know, where there's a lot of funding and then there's the funding dries up. In fact, 3,500 in the U.S., 3,500 scientists since 2012 lost their major source of funding and are at risk of not being able to keep their labs open or can't keep them open. So that just makes it hard to be a career scientist doing basic science research if your funding sources are so unpredictable, you know? It's like putting out a lot of food for the birds, and then when the bird population increases, you get lazy and stop putting the food out and they all die, you know?
Yeah.
There needs to be a consistent source. Sorry, I made a bird analogy there, but there's got to be a consistent source of funding so that people can reliably keep their labs open, keep, you know, hire people, keep their infrastructure. And this boom and bust basic science funding based upon, you know, the whims of politicians is a real problem. The other point I wanted to just emphasize is that this is one, in my opinion, this is one of the missions of government. You know, we could sort of excuse corporations for looking at the next quarter and because they got to, whatever, meet the expectations of their shareholders. But governments should be looking at the long-term interests of society, making those long-term investments that corporations can't make. If the governments start looking at the next election and not funding long-term projects, then we're totally screwed.
Yep.
Yes.
But, well, you know, totally. And that opens up a whole new discussion of the problem of corporations running government.
Yeah.
I mean, at least in the United States, it's been happening more and more. And we've seen the impact that has on science funding. So I think the two go hand in hand.
Yep.
All right. Well, we're not going to solve that problem tonight.
It's complex.
It's complicated, but it's a problem. It's very complicated. It's a problem that deserves attention because, you know,
yes.
Our long-term interests are best served by having a basic science research program that's reliable. Okay, Bob, we're going to just turn to a fun, cool item. You're going to tell us about Dreadnoughtus.
So more dinosaur news recently, guys. Everybody loves this stuff. This is about the biggest one with an asterisk ever found. And like many dinos, and unlike astronomical discoveries, it has a really cool name, Dreadnoughtus. A Dreadnoughtus, this is a very special sauropod, plant-eating dinosaur, discovered in 2005 in Argentina, and it's recently been published in the journal Scientific Reports. So guys, I'm curious, what do you think when you hear the term dreadnought? What comes to mind?
There's a dreadnought class of ships.
The Star Trek, starship.
Yeah, I have like a 30-year-old memory of just a funky, it looked just like the Enterprise, but it had three warp nacelles. and it had like the shuttle bay was in the front. And so that just comes to mind. I'm not sure. It wasn't in any of the series, of course. It was just, I think there was a book that had it in there, and there's some interesting drawings. If you search for Star Trek and Dreadnought, you'll see some amazing designs of the ship. But that, of course, is completely unrelated to what we're talking about. Now, I know the scientists weren't thinking of Star Trek, obviously, when they came up with the idea of Dreadnoughtus as that name. It means fears nothing, and they based it on the revolutionary Dreadnought battleships from over a century ago, because at that time they seemed so impervious and intimidating. And I also, one of the lead researchers was saying that he wanted people to understand that plant eaters could be badass as well as the meat eaters. So there are three things about this dinosaur that really make it special, I think, in my mind. Its size, its completeness, and my favorite thing about it is its tail. Now, the size. I know a lot of people are saying and complaining about the size and that this thing, it's not the biggest. But here are the facts. Dreadnoughtus, it's part of a catch-all controversial family of dinosaurs with the great name of Titanosaurs, one of my favorite dinosaur names. This group has in it the biggest piles of protoplasm that ever walked on the earth, such as Argentinosaurus and Paralititan. So Dreadnoughtus is pretty much right up there with the big dogs. He was at least 85 feet long, which includes 30-foot tail, and weighed about 65 tons. So this guy was gargantuan. So that's bigger than my house, and about 9 times the weight of a T-Rex. So clearly, wow. Clearly,
we have a T-Rex.
Brobdingnagian. So the other cool thing is that the one they found wasn't even full grown. It was immature. Still though, as big as it was, Dreadnoughtus was not the biggest ever, it seems. Argentinosaurus is probably the biggest one that ever existed. Estimates put him close to 100 feet long and more than 73 tons. Some numbers even make him heavier and even longer. So I think it's pretty well accepted that one is probably the biggest one that we've found so far. But that's the rub though, the word estimate. The error bars are much wider for Argentinosaurus than Dreadnoughtus. So because of that, you can technically say it's the heaviest dino ever if you factor in the confidence levels. And then this relates to my next segment here about completeness. And one of the surprising things about Titanosaurs is how incomplete the fossils are with these guys. The actual number of fossilized bones we have for them is surprisingly low. So Argentinosaurus, for example, they've got 13 bones. 13, that's it. And it's mostly backbones. I think there's a little bit of the hip and there's a little bit of the lower leg bone, the fibula. But even worse though, they aren't the bones, those specific bones that paleontologists consider to be the gold standard for determining the weight of quadrupeds. They're just a couple bones that are the perfect ones to have if you want to be accurate. And they're the femur, the thigh bone, and the humerus, which is the upper arm. So when you extrapolate from so few bones, it can only give you a very wide range of potential weights. Dreadnoughtus, on the other hand, has over 100 bones, and plus they found 30 more bones from another specimen. And so this adds to about a 45% complete Titanosaur. And another way to look at it, you could also say that it's instead of 45% complete, it's really 70% complete if you consider the duplicate bone types. I mean, if you have one leg, you don't really need the other leg. You essentially have both of them. And then, of course, the icing on the cake was that they had a femur and they had a humerus for Dreadnoughtus. So this means that the estimated weight is way more accurate for the Dreadnoughtus than any others. And that's why you can say that it's the biggest, because that's how confident they are. Although it really wasn't the biggest. It's the biggest one that we're very, very confident about. And then finally, the tail. This is just so cool. One of the lead researchers describes its tail as probably the most powerful that has ever been seen. If you think about it, it's no surprise that a 30-foot long titanosaur tail has got tons of muscle all over it. But this one was even more muscular than they ever would have projected at all. Dinosaurs have these bones called chevrons, which is a really cool name for a bone. So this is the bone. You might see them, like if you see a tailbone, these are the bones that are underneath it. They kind of look weird and out of place, but actually what they do is they anchor the muscles. So if you look at most of chevrons from any other dinosaur, the chevrons taper to a point on the bottom, but not Dreadnoughtus. It starts to taper a little bit and then it gets really crazy wide. Which means that it had a huge amount of surface area for muscle attachments. And you could see the muscle insertion scars and things on this bone. So clearly there was huge chunks of muscle attached to these chevrons, meaning that the tail was incredibly impressive. I love how the researchers refer to it as a weaponized tail. And it really was. And I think that with that tail, and if you consider a full-grown Dreadnoughtus, even bigger than the one that they found, these researchers think that they could pretty much have taken any comers at all. Any other dinosaur that was alive at that time probably could not have taken this guy. So he was pretty impressive, especially for a plant eater.
Bob, you're saying that they can look at the bones?
Look at the bones.
Yeah, this is certainly not the biggest bad boy that we're going to find. There's got to be bigger ones out there.
Yeah. But it's just amazing. We might, you know, it could be quite some time that we ever find, you know, a titanosaur this complete. It really seems mm-hmm. anomalous at this point. So it's so helpful that we at least found one, because at least now we could extrapolate to other titanosaurs and try to learn more about, you know, what their lives were like.
But Bob, how did this guy fit on the ark?
Very careful.
Didn't. That's why he's dead.
Big
That's right. Well, you know,
big snorkel, real big snorkel.
Well, Rebecca, I understand that a website is being sued over being mean to a dietary supplement company.
Yeah, that is close to being correct, but it's actually much worse than that.
Oh,
so,
yeah.
Roca Labs is a dietary supplement company who claim to sell an item that allows people to lose weight, effectively recreating the way a gastric bypass works, but without the surgery.
Oh.
So it's this tub of what appears to be pink phloem. I'm not sure if listeners are familiar with the
Chicken McNugget stuff.
Branded phloem from the 90s, but
oh, that.
Yeah, so they claim basically to limit your stomach's total volume so that you feel full and you can't eat as much, and you will lose hundreds of pounds in several months. Their website is full of what you might feel are the typical sort of nutritional supplement disclaimers. They do say something about being with the FDA. What do they say? Hold on, I've got it right here.
They say like FDA compliant, but
yes, FDA compliance is one of their little tabs. And when
they
you open it
they
up,
got a letter from the FDA or something. Yeah, that there we can say this now.
But they have to have the quack Miranda warning of these claims have not been reviewed by the FDA.
Yeah,
and
when you
not
click,
intended to treat or cure any disease.
When you click the FDA compliance link, you're shown a literally 30-second long video of a man in a lab coat with a stethoscope around his neck, explaining that it's manufactured in an FDA-registered facility.
There you go.
Yeah, close enough. So, you know, I don't know how this is supposed to work. I don't know if it works, but I can tell you that many, many people are reporting that it does not work for them. Despite the fact that one part of the regimen is full commitment to diet and exercise, which I think is odd. I feel like if that is part of your regimen, then it doesn't really matter what else you're tacking onto it.
Yeah.
That's a weight loss guarantee.
Eat one green M&M per day, diet and exercise, and you'll lose weight.
Exactly. This is what Kevin Trudeau got in trouble for, actually.
Mm.
So it starts at only $480. So I'm not about to try it out and report back. But yeah, I can tell you that many people have tried it and they are not happy. So there is apparently when you order from Roca Labs, part of their process is that by ordering, you must agree to not ever say anything bad about the company or the product. Also, by the way, there are no returns after the product is opened.
Yeah. So specifically what they do, I have it right in front of me. It's their discount policy. If you get the discount, then this is exactly what it says. As part of this endorsement, you also agree not to write any negative reviews about RLN or our products. Customers never have to take advantage of this savings program. Most do, and you can always pay full price. So you could pay hundreds of dollars more, or you can never say anything negative about the company or their product.
Yeah. And now this in and of itself is of dubious legality. I will leave it to the lawyers in the audience to worry about that. But one website has provided consumers with a forum for complaining about any company. It's called Pissed Consumer. And you can go in there and you can complain about anything you want. And so there is a page for Roka Labs. And the complaints are pretty vicious. People claiming that it absolutely does not work. It tastes horrible. It's expensive. This person says it cost them over $700. So I'm sure there are plenty of add-ons that they do. People really seem to hate it. So what does Roka Labs do? Well, they do the obvious. They sue Pissed Consumer. You may be thinking, now wait a minute. It's the consumers who supposedly agreed to this, you know, agreement of dubious legality to never say anything bad about the company, not Pissed Consumer. However, Roka Labs is alleging in their lawsuit that Pissed Consumer is encouraging customers to violate their contract. And because of that, they are up for being sued. So there's pretty much like no way, I hope. Again, I'm not a lawyer, but I cannot imagine that this will go anywhere. And what this appears to be to me is a company simply trying to silence criticism. It doesn't matter if they stand a hope of winning this lawsuit. What matters is if they're able to scare Pissed Consumer into taking the easy road, which would be to just delete all of the complaints about Roka Labs and the lawsuit will go away. As far as I know, Pissed Consumer is not backing down, and hopefully they will continue to stand up to Roka Labs. And as is the nature of the internet in what is known as the Streisand effect, I hope that this action on behalf of Roka Labs leads to a hell of a lot more criticism of Roka Labs than they were ever getting before. So this is my small way of hopefully contributing to that.
I looked into this myself, Rebecca, and a couple other wrinkles I thought were interesting. First, I went to the Better Business Bureau website, and Roka Labs has a fair number of complaints there as well.
They do get an F from the Better Business Bureau.
But what's interesting is after many of the complaints, the Roka Labs responds. And in some of them, their response is, Roka Labs views the Better Business Bureau as an unfair, profitable organization based upon, and they have a link to their own site, which is using unfair grading system. So they disp the Better Business Bureau because they're getting complaints there as well. The other thing, the interesting little wrinkle here is it's possible that Pissed Consumer is not entirely innocent in all this either. I found a 2010 lawsuit by a different company against Pissed Consumer, and they accused Pissed Consumer of, the parent company of the Opinion Corps that pays the company. They accused them of soliciting particularly negative reviews and then using them to essentially blackmail companies into buying their custom reputation management services. Essentially, if you pay them, they'll take down or hide or make less prominent the negative complaints against your company.
Wow.
That was the accusation against them. I don't know if that went anywhere.
Yeah, if you look on the Pissed Consumer website, like on the Roka Labs page, there on the sidebar, it's like, is this your company? Learn about our business solutions. And then if you click through to that, you can see, sure enough, yeah, they're premium business solutions for getting – they don't say anything about deleting the negative reviews. It's just like be informed about the complaints and comments that show up on your company profile. And then there is something called profile editing, and you – if you go for their $250 account option, you can give official responses to consumer comments. That's $250 a month. So yeah, they are definitely a seedy bunch of jerks.
Yeah. The other sort of legitimate type of complaint that arose in this other lawsuit was the accusation that some of these comments are not from users, but they're from rival companies who are trying to trash the reputation of their competition. Mm. And sure, that could happen. Yeah.
That
could happen on any website. Right. Absolutely. But it does, you know, this is one of those dark areas of the internet, in my opinion, where people can go straight to a public forum without there being any kind of filter or evaluation. And, you know, you could have your reputation trashed in a way that's completely mm-hmm. unfair. And then you're a jerk for suing to try to get it rectified. So it's kind of a lose-lose. You know, this is part of the wild west of the internet that's kind of hard to know where the right balance is, you know.
But at the same time, this is something that literally every company has to deal with.
Yeah.
And for the most part, this isn't a problem because they don't offer draconian, you know, set out these draconian guidelines for their customers and abuse them in the way that Roka Labs appears to be doing.
So yeah, looking through the Roka Labs website, they certainly present themselves, in my opinion, as snake oil peddlers. I mean, they're all these kind of hyped claims, you know, instant gastric bypass without surgery, basically. You know, all the testimonials and the, you know, trying to pretend like they have some kind of FDA nod when in fact the FDA has not reviewed their claims. Everything, all the typical, every red flag basically of snake oil is there. And then they also seem to be very litigious. I mean, the whole notion of trying to say, all right, if you get the discounted price, you have to then endorse our product, send us videos of your weight loss, and you could never say anything negative about us or our product. That's just scummy. That's just ridiculous.
And also, I don't think it's enforceable. Can you actually?
No, I don't think so. But the fact that they would say it, I mean, the chutzpah is incredible. One final news item. This is a note about a friend of ours, actually, Brian Dunning, the host of Skeptoid. Now, many of our listeners have probably already heard this, but we've never discussed it on the show. Back in 2007, Brian was charged with wire fraud, this relating to a business he had at the time. Again, nothing to do with his skeptical activities. And recently was both convicted and sentenced. He's going to be spending a short amount of time in prison for the conviction of wire fraud. So we initially didn't discuss this for a very specific reason, and that is that we, just as a matter of policy, do not want to spend a lot of time on the show talking about a lot of the activity and drama that's occurring within the skeptical community, within the skeptical movement. You know, we don't really see ourselves as an insider trade show. We are an outreach program trying to promote science and critical thinking. And it's actually, for those who do, you know, read the blogs and follow everything that's happening within the skeptical community, you realize we could be talking about stuff every week. There's so much going on. So initially we filed it under, this is the sort of thing we don't talk about on the show, but many people have been writing us and suggesting that we should at least mention it. Because we've had Brian on the show before, we have promoted Skeptoid, and just in the interest of transparency, we should at least mention that this has occurred, and we'll refer you to the many blogs and things that have been written online. You could learn everything you want to learn about this from Brian's perspective, other people's perspective, and again, we'll provide links to that information. All right, well, Evan, we're going to move on to Who's That Noisy? We probably have to get caught up going a couple of weeks back.
Yeah, we'll get caught up. Episode 476 featured this noisy. Do you guys remember? Here we go. Yeah. No, that was not Jay.
It wasn't Homer Simpson.
It was not Homer Simpson. It was not Chewbacca. It was not the myriad of other guesses that people gave, and none of them gave the correct answer. I thought somewhere a donkeyologist would, you know, ring in and say, I know exactly what that is. That's a donkey. Because that's exactly what that is.
That was a donkey?
That was a
Christmas donkey.
Donkey?
I thought it was Homer Simpson.
So a lot of people thought it was Homer Simpson. You know, donkeys make some interesting noises. I stumped everyone in the world of jackasses. So in a way, that's good.
Make sure the king jackass.
Yay!
You're the king of the jackasses. Here's your crown, you majesty.
Okay, so enough of the donkeying around here. Followed after that, episode 477, of course, we had this particular Who's That Noisy? There were a lot of correct answers with this one, but here we go. Who is this?
We need science. In the 10 years ahead, they say we need them by thousands more than we're now presently planning to have.
It appears we've been having this problem for a long time.
A lot of people guessed correctly that that was Dwight D. Eisenhower. Yes, from his radio and TV address titled Our Future Security. So, yep. Talks a little bit about the situation going on back then in the 1950s. Many correct answers, but only one winner each week. Greg McNeil, you are this week's winner for guessing correctly in episode 477. Congratulations, your name goes into the hat. End of the year, if we draw your name, you'll be joining us for an episode of Science or Fiction in early 2015. Oh, we got this week's.
Yeah, let's hear it.
It's short. Here we go.
With me, it started with the moon, believe it or not, when I was a student. You see, I was 13 then.
That's it. That's all you're going to get. I think we'll get some correct answers on this one as well. And send your correct answers into our email for Who's That Noisy, which is WTN@theskepticsguide.org. Or post your answer on our forums, SGUforums.com. Good luck, everyone.
Thank you, Evan.
Thank you.
We have a couple of corrections to chat about from recent episodes. A few episodes ago, the phrase, the exception proves the rule, came up. And I pointed out that one interpretation of that, because it seems counterintuitive, how could the exception prove the rule, that another interpretation of the word prove is test, and that maybe the phrase means the exception tests the rule. There are some sources which give that as the interpretation of that saying, but many of our listeners pointed out that that's actually incorrect and that the saying actually dates back to a legal notion that the existence of an exception proves, or from which you can infer, the existence of a more general rule. For example, if you read a sign that says no parking on Sundays, you can infer from that the general rule that you could park at other times. So the exception proves that there must be a rule, otherwise you wouldn't have had to point out the exception. So I looked into it, and that does seem to be the correct actual original source of that phrase, the exception proves a rule, not the other one, you know, interpreting the word prove to mean test, which, again, some people have given that as the explanation, but I don't think that's correct. I think it's the legal one seems to go back further. Did you find that too, Rebecca? I know we were both hoodwinked by that incorrect folk etymology.
I found that as well.
Yeah. Okay. And then, all right, another correction. This one's interesting because this is a correction to something that never made it on the show because it came up during our live DragonCon show. Jay, you were talking about eating insects, right? Remember the insect eating segment from the live DragonCon show?
How could I forget? Yes.
Yeah. By comparison, you were talking about the meat processing industry, and you made a statement that I wanted to check out because it didn't sit right with me.
I made two statements.
Yeah, so go ahead. Tell us what you said that was wrong. So this is, you're correcting this for the online, for the live listeners because they were misinformed, but there's actually an interesting story behind all of this.
Yeah, there is. Well, all right, so this is what I got wrong. I said, Steve is smarter than me.
Yeah, that's wrong.
That's patently wrong. No, what I said was, I said that the meat industry and the leather industry don't work together. That there are cows that are raised for meat, and then there are cows that are raised specifically for leather. Secondly, I said that moles are picked up when they're harvesting tomato plants to make ketchup, and maybe a lot of other tomato products. That moles are accidentally caught up in the machines, and there are insects and moles in your ketchup. You know, there's a certain amount of insect and animal matter that's allowed to be in a ketchup bottle. So, Steve, Steve looked these two points up that I made during this live show, and they seem to be wrong. And this is the lesson here. It's perfectly okay and normal to have misinformation in your head. We all have it. Who knows who told me that or where I read that how many years ago about, you know, the meat and leather industries not crisscrossing. I have no memory of where it got in, but it's been a fact since I can remember. I thought that that was the truth. And it turns out after a lot of research, and feel free to email us if you have better information, but the research that Steve and I did over the past week We found that to be absolutely wrong. That specifically what we found out was that, yes, there is a lot of regulation happening in the meat industry, particularly in the United States, but there's a lot of countries that are all joined together with similar regulations to be to treat animals correctly, to be humane in their treatment, to minimize the amount of fear that they experience, and the whole experience of the animal going through the process of it being slaughtered. There's an incredible amount of hype on the internet that talks about this, and there's a lot of, you know, groups of people out there like PETA and a lot of others that are just absolutely convinced that, you know, animals are being treated poorly. And you know what? Sometimes they're right. There are absolutely places out there that treat animals horribly. And I saw a lot of videos I wish I didn't have to see to do the research for this. But there are a lot of laws and regulation in place, and there is an ideal path that a lot of the companies are moving towards that minimizes the experience of the animals. Now,
yeah, there was a very interesting video produced by the American Meat Institute and hosted by Dr. Temple Grandin. And they show this is what the process should be like. And they said many large beef processing plants use these techniques, which, as Jay said, you know, the cows, it minimizes any fear or anxiety. They don't see what's happening. And they're killed. It's done with a gun, essentially, that delivers a high-velocity iron bolt directly into their brain. So before they know what happens, it just instantly lights off. So, I mean, it was watching that video, which actually, you know, was didn't just talk. It showed you, you know, all the way through the process.
That bolt does kill them, though. They don't walk around with a changed personality or anything.
No.
Take them out.
just the frontal lobes.
It costs a lot of money to raise cattle. They take up land. They require a ton of food and water and care. And the industry that backs raising cattle and slaughtering cattle obviously is going to want to make as much money out of their product, which is the animal, as they can. So it makes absolutely no sense that they would slaughter an animal and throw away a ton of the body of the animal and just keep, you know, the most choice pieces of meat that they can get out of it. They are and actively trying to sell every single scrap that they can get, that they could possibly find a buyer for. And the skin and the hide is actually a huge portion of their income off of the animal. I believe it's 10% of the profits that they make.
Mm-hmm.
See, right? You read that as well?
10% of the profits or 50% of the meat byproducts. Basically everything other than the meat, half of it, of that money they get for each cow comes from the leather. So, yeah, in looking into this, tried to come at this from as many different angles as I could, and every primary information about how meat processing plants work showed, matter-of-factly, that they absolutely harvest and sell the leather. So the leather does come from the same cows that the meat comes from. You know, again, why would they waste it? It's an additional source of income. But it is true that some ranchers and some processing plants do make a specific effort to get higher quality leather. So for example, like there was one company that was basically advertising itself as our meat cows have really good leather because we work specifically with ranchers to minimize scratches and any injuries to the leather, to the hide, et cetera. And they use a certain process, you know, in terms of preparing the leather. So you can, you know, for better quality leather, you can raise the cows and protect them in a certain way to optimize for that. But that doesn't mean that they're not harvesting the leather off of other cows also. I mean, they are.
And the softest leathers are, you know, calf leathers, and those come from fetuses that are cut out of their mother's womb. So just seeing that something is like a high quality leather doesn't necessarily mean that means that cow was, you know, babied during its life.
Oh, no. I mean, yeah, and there's other sources of leather as well. Like leather from deer is very,
very soft.
Exotic
animals as well.
Yeah. So if animals are hunted for their hides and their leather as well. Yeah. Just the specific point is like the leather from meat cows is not wasted. It's also used.
But Steve, there are a lot of exotic animals that are specifically harvested just for their skin.
Yes. Yeah, which is wrong, obviously, especially if they're endangered, you know.
But I do welcome emails. I mean, I want to know if anybody is a professional in the industry that has a deeper knowledge.
But what's interesting is that when you search for this, a lot of the top sites that come up are claiming that, that essentially leather is not a meat byproduct. It's a separate thing. And, but they're all PETA and vegetarian sites and vegan sites. You know, they're all sites that are anti-meat, you know. But when you actually then just find out, just ask the question, what's actually happening in these meat processing plants? They're absolutely harvesting and using the leather. The other point that you made about the moles in the ketchup. So what I found was from the FDA and from other sites. I mean, so insect parts, absolutely. Pretty much any processed food or any food that's going through a plant like that, they tolerate scarily high numbers of insect fragments. There's basically insect fragments everywhere. So just don't worry about it.
It's not going to kill
they
you.
They also tolerate a certain amount of rodent hair and feces.
Yeah, that was the one I remember from, I grew up in a town with a ketchup factory, and we were always told that, like, yeah, there's rat hair and bugs all over it.
But I don't think whole moles or animals are getting in there. I think that was a myth. But yeah, but hair and feces, absolutely. All right, guys. Well, let's move on to science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. We just have three regular news items this week, no theme.
Hooray!
Yay!
Aww.
But I think you will find them very interesting.
Boo.
Here they are.
Oh, wow.
Item number one. Researchers have, for the first time, constructed a two-dimensional material called germanine out of a single layer of germanium atoms. Item number two. Scientists have discovered a new fundamental mechanism of aging linked to faulty DNA repair. And item number three. A new study confirms that in some individuals, sugar has an effect on the brain similar to narcotics, causing a drug-like addiction. Jay, go first.
All right, this first one about the researchers that constructed a two-dimensional material, and they couldn't come up with anything better than calling it germanium out of a single germanium atom. Germanium.
Germanium.
Absolutely.
Germanium.
It's a two-dimensional
Okay. So I have two questions for you, Steve. Number one, is this germane to the topic? And number two, what does Germany have to do with this news item?
Germanium was named after Germany.
Okay, just asking. All right, why not? Okay, these guys were totally uninspired in their name-giving abilities, and they came up with this cool layering thing made out of germanium. Gotcha. Okay, I don't have any problem with that, other than the name. The second one here about the scientists that discovered this fundamental mechanism of aging, and it's linked to faulty DNA repair. Now, I've read many times different theories about what causes aging and telomeres and DNA, you know, duplicates. And then during the duplication process, it duplicates with errors and, you know, in essence, that results in aging. So I could see this one being science very easily. And the final one here is the study confirms that some individuals' sugar has an effect in the brain similar to narcotics, causing a drug-like addiction. See, now this is where I run into the problem, because all three of these seem absolutely cromulent. A drug-like addiction. So some people are processing sugar or having a reaction to sugar that is giving them some drug-like addiction. I'm going to say that one is the fake for a couple of reasons. One, I don't think that there is something wrong with people like that. I don't think it's that profound. I think that this is wrong. I think that people might get emotionally addicted, and, you know, some people could definitely be diabetic and have a problem with sugar, but I don't think that they're experiencing it like a drug the way it's described here. That's fiction.
Okay, Evan?
For the first time constructed it, so I don't know what could possibly even be wrong with this one. I think that one's science. The next one about a new fundamental mechanism of aging. Jay, you said you've looked into this before as well. We've mentioned it before on the show. It sounds like that one's right. That leaves the last one. Sugar has an effect on the brain similar to narcotics, causing a drug-like addiction. Okay, so I think sugar has to go through much more processing before it has any sort of brain effect. So I'm like Jay. I'm thinking that this one's going to wind up being the fiction, and sugar effect on the brain, fiction.
Okay, Bob.
See, the two-dimensional material
germinating. I assume you don't mean really two-dimensional, but just like single layer of atoms. Yeah, I don't think that's a huge deal. I think we've done that with other atoms before. I want to go to the third one, sugar's a drug-like effect of sugar on the brain. I've got a little bit of a problem with that. Seems to have taken a long time to figure that out. But there could be a subset of the population that has that kind of reaction. But I'm still a little skeptical of that. But I would select it if it weren't for number two. Fundamental mechanism for aging linked to a faulty DNA repair. We knew about that a long time ago. That's not a new fundamental mechanism. And we haven't, discovered a new fundamental mechanism in quite some time. I think it's like two decades, between two and three decades. It's quite some time. It seemed like we pretty much nailed all of them. Not that we couldn't find another one, but just the fact that this one, I'm pretty sure we were already aware of this. There might be some wrinkle to this I'm not seeing, but because of that, I'm going to say that that is fiction.
And Rebecca.
Ugh. Well, that didn't help me at all.
Sorry.
Yeah, so germinating sounds like graphene to me, and if we can do it with graphene, why not with germanium? So I don't know enough about graphene to be able to say why that's not correct, but it certainly makes sense to me. So I was torn between the other two, because to me, as Bob said, the idea of faulty DNA repair being linked to aging is so obvious and old. I was thinking, oh, well, this must be the fiction because, you know, Steve's trying to lead us into something we know is obviously true. But then I've got the opposite reaction to the sugar thing. Again, we have long known that sugar is not in any way addictive and that it's just a placebo for the most part when it comes to, you know, us thinking of children being wired up on cake and ice cream. So this would be a really surprising study. So I'm going to stick with the sugar as being the fiction.
Oh boy. Okay.
No, sorry, Bob.
Sweet.
I can't blame you. You make sense too.
Okay. So you all agree that researchers for the first time have constructed a two-dimensional material called germanine out of a single layer of germanium atoms. You all think that one is science and that one is science.
Yeah, baby.
Hooray.
Now what's special about this?
Yes.
Well, it's like graphene.
Germanium.
But it's made out of germanium atoms. Interestingly, it has a very similar structure, kind of like that honeycomb type of structure to it. Germanium is a solid at room temperature semi-metal, atomic number 32.
Oh, I like that, semi-metal.
Yeah. Used in semiconductor industry. They predicted that this should work a couple years ago, but they had trouble figuring out how to make it. And then researchers used platinum as a template, and it worked well. That obviously would limit mass production. If you need to use platinum as sort of your base, then you sort of, you know, layer the germanium atoms on top of them, and it sort of attracts them and holds them in place. Then you get this sheet like graphene, but made of germanium, the germanine. But if they could, you know, come up with a different material that to replace the platinum, and that would enable it to be more mass produced. And, you know, obviously they have to explore the properties. This could have very interesting properties in the electronics industry, etc. So will this be the new graphene? Who knows? We'll have to wait and see. All right, let's go on to number two. Scientists have discovered a new fundamental mechanism of aging linked to faulty DNA repair. Bob thinks this one is the fiction. Everyone else thinks this one is science. And this one is science.
Right.
Sorry, Bob.
Wow, that sucks, Bob.
I thought I might get you on this one, Bob, because of the whole new mechanism of aging thing. So.
I hate being smart.
So.
Bob, that's the best comeback. I love it.
What's new is the mechanism of faulty DNA repair.
Aha, I was right.
What they found was that, and this is a study in mice, that young mice, when there's a break in the DNA, that the DNA repairs itself essentially by the two ends stitching back together. But that this mechanism stops happening as the mice get older, and instead they rely upon a different mechanism of DNA repair where the two ends overlap. They basically will find a sequence on the two loose ends that are homologous, you know, so that will bind together. And then the DNA sort of repairs itself, but the two ends overlap, and that can cause a problem with the reading of any genes in the overlap in that area. So it's an imperfect way of repairing the break in the DNA strand, and that occurs with age. So younger mice, when they induce the breaks, they repair them more efficiently and by knitting the ends together, and in older mice, they repair the breaks less efficiently, and they rely upon this imperfect method of overlapping the DNA rather than putting the ends together. Isn't that cool?
That's cool.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay.
Fundamental.
Which means that a new study confirms that in some individuals, sugar has an effect on the brain similar to narcotics, causing a drug-like addiction, is complete and utter fiction. It has been proposed that sugar has drug-like addictive properties on the brain, but never confirmed.
Well, they were wrong then, weren't they?
They were wrong then, weren't they? And a new study shows that eating addiction is more of a behavioral phenomenon, mm-hmm, and not a drug-like addiction. They specifically say it is not a drug-like addiction. Sugar does not have any drug-like effects on the brain. It does not cause addiction. However, some people may have an unhealthy behavioral relationship with food, or even with sugar specifically. And they say that should be looked at more like a gambling addiction. It's really just a problem behavior. It's not really an addiction. All right, so good work, guys, except for Bob. Bob,
yep. Thank you.
Suckered in. Sorry about that.
It's just not your year, Bob.
It was a challenging one, this one.
Yeah, it was tough.
Wow, Jay.
It was tough. It was tough.
Right, Ev? You got to play hard when you're tough, man.
Hey, the year's not over yet. Anyone could capture it. All right, well, Jay, do you got a quote for us?
Aaron Watkins from Cleveland, Ohio, sent in this awesome quote. And this is a quote from an author named James Baldwin. People who shut their eyes to reality simply invite their own destruction, and anyone who insists on remaining in a state of innocence long after that innocence is dead turns himself into a monster. That was a quote by James Baldwin! Anybody know who James Baldwin is?
Brother with Adam and the other actors.
Wasn't he a part of the Harlem Renaissance?
It says here, James Arthur Baldwin, he died in 87. 1924 to 1987, was an American novelist, essayist, playwright, poet, and social critic.
Yeah.
So, guys, October 2nd, Thursday, October 2nd, at 8 mm-hmm. p.m. Eastern Time, mm-hmm. we are going to have a special recording of the SGU where we're going to – we did this before. We're going to invite 20 listeners to join us on a GoToMeeting group chat, and we will answer all of your burning questions on the show.
I think that's
super
fantastic.
Excited. Yeah, we did it once before. And
it was a lot of fun.
A lot of fun.
It was really cool.
We're going to do it again. So this is how it works. Email us at info@theskepticsguide.org. Put live recording in the subject line. And we will look at all requests to be on that show between now and Wednesday, September 24th. So you'll have about a week and a half to email us. And then we are going to take the 20 responders in that period of time who have the highest membership level in the SGU. So we have a little bit of an advantage to SGU members, but anyone who sends it in will have a chance at getting on that show. And again, we did this before. It was a lot of fun.
And if you're a non-member, feel free to register, but we're giving this perk out to our members that they get seating first.
Yeah, but if you do become a member, you get access to premium content. Do you know that we generate extra SGU content? Most weeks there are, as of this recording, there are 36 extra pieces of premium content that you would get immediate access to if you become a premium member or higher. That's the $8 a month. That's it. That's like $2 a week, and you get access to all that extra content.
And you can support the SGU at the same time.
It's a bonus.
Really quick announcement. October 25th, I'll be at the Bay Area Science Festival. I'm going to be having a Quizotron with people like Phil Plate and Annalie Newitz of IO9 and Yao Man Chan, who's been on SGU.
Yay!
Tickets will go on sale next week. I will give you an update then, but keep the date open, October 25th at the Castro Theater.
Yeah, hey, and I'm going to be on a live recording of the Rationally Speaking podcast. This will be on Sunday, September 28th at 2 p.m. at the Baruch Performing Arts Center, 55 Lexington Avenue on 25th Street between Lexington and 3rd Avenue. We'll have a link in the show notes. So this is a fun podcast with Massimo Piliucci and Julia Galef, and then I'll be joining them for a live recording. We're going to talk about the scope of scientific skepticism and a lot of other interesting topics as well. So join us if you can. It's free and open to the public. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Thank you, Steve.
Sure, Steve.
Good to be quantumly entangled with you.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. We'll be right back.